Tony Mazzacapa was originally scheduled to speak on this subject this morning, so those of you who know him can see that I'm neither bald nor Italian, but I am with him at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, and also I'm affiliated with the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, and I spend most of my time doing work for the TerraScale Supernova Initiative, about which I'll say more later in the talk. So there are three main parts of my talk today. First, I'll talk about what are supernovae, and then I'll talk about sort of the status of collapse simulations as they've been going on over the last few years. And then I'll talk about the future and what's going on now with the TerraScale Supernova Initiative. So first, what are supernovae? The name itself, the word supernova, dates from the 1930s, but the concept was around in the 1920s, with the realization that the spiral nebulae were actually galaxies in their own right, comparable to our own Milky Way. It was realized that the novae, or new stars, seen in those external galaxies would have to be much, much brighter than the novae seen in our own galaxy. So in the 1920s, terms such as giant novae, novae of impossibly great absolute magnitudes, exceptional novae, this is my favorite, the German Hauptnovae, or chief novae. These are the kinds of terms used to describe this concept in the 20s. The word supernova was claimed to have been coined by Bodd and Zwicky. Here's a review article written by Zwicky, and he explained how it was deduced that there were these two classes of novae. Here that's described in terms of these perverse sort of logarithmic units that only astronomers can love, but if you translate them into a normal kind of thing, it's that supernovae are about 1,000 times as luminous as common novae. So he said this term supernovae was first introduced in a lecture course on astrophysics in 1931 at Caltech. Supernovae are classified by astronomers into two basic classes, depending on the presence or absence of hydrogen features, which divide type 1 and type 2. And the type 1s are further subdivided into type 1A, 1B, and 1C, depending on presence or absence of silicon or helium features. And there are some subdivisions of the type 2s as well. So in these representative spectra, here you can see the obvious silicon feature that distinguishes type 1A, and the obvious hydrogen lines in type 2. Helium line present in type 1B, and the absence of all of these in a type 1C. There's also some light curve classifications of supernovae. The light curves of type 1As have a sort of standardizable shape that makes them a standardizable candle to be useful for cosmological studies. The type 2s have a more bewildering variety in their light curves. As you can see, kind of the variety there. Okay, so that's the observational distinctions between the classes of supernovae. As far as physical classification, there are also two major subcategories, but these do not line up cleanly with the observational categories of type 1 and type 2. So the first main physical mechanism is a thermonuclear runaway, and this is thought to be involved in type 1A supernovae. It involves accretion of matter from a companion star onto a white dwarf until this process ignites a thermonuclear runaway that consumes the entire white dwarf. The other physical mechanism is the core collapse of a massive star. So this is operative in type 2s and also the type 1b and type 1c's. So in this case, the observational distinctions of presence or absence of hydrogen and helium are not directly related to the mechanism itself, but rather to whether the outer layers of the star were stripped away by winds or losing material to a binary companion or something like that before the collapse occurred. So let's look at this process of core collapse in a little more detail. For most of their lives, stars burn hydrogen to helium, and as you zoom into higher and higher densities, you can see what happens in massive stars where temperatures and densities are reached that are sufficient to burn the hydrogen first to carbon and then oxygen, neon, magnesium, until finally you can burn to silicon and iron, and that's the top of the that's the point at which no further binding energy can be extracted from fusion. And so once this iron core builds up sufficiently, it becomes unstable. So this part here is meant to represent this iron core. And when it becomes unstable, it starts to collapse. The inner part here, represented in purple, collapses subsonically. And the outer part is then collapsing supersonically. One of the instabilities leading to collapse is electron capture that results in the emission of neutrinos. So that happens throughout the collapse. There comes a point, though, when densities are high enough for even the neutrinos to be trapped. And collapse is finally halted when a little bit beyond nuclear densities are reached. And at that point, when the subsonic portion, inner portion of the core halts, a shockwave forms because the outer supersonically infalling layers haven't heard the news yet. So when this shock forms, it's represented by this thin orange shell, it bounces and begins to move out. And so this yellow material is heated by the shock. And the neutrinos, depicted here in this case by the red arrows, are emitted from the dense nascent neutron star. So this newly born neutron star is a dense thermal bath of dense nuclear matter and electron-positron pairs and photons and neutrinos. And neutrinos, because they have the weakest interactions, are the most efficient means of cooling. So their emission here is denoted by these fat pink arrows. And in sort of the what has been kind of the standard paradigm for how the explosion takes place for some time now, these neutrino fluxes are taken to heat the layers here behind the shock. The shock stalls because after bouncing and beginning to move out, it stalls because of energy losses from neutrinos in these deeper layers, and also because matter falling through iron and silicon and so forth, those heavy elements become dissociated as it falls through the shock, and that also causes a loss of energy. But with the continued neutrino emission, this may heat these layers behind the stalled shock and propel it forward to give a successful explosion. Now, this neutrino heating may be aided by convection in two regions. The electron neutrino emission from the outer layers here causes a composition gradient that causes convection. And so this can bring hotter material to the surface and boost neutrino luminosities. In addition, in the heating region just behind the shock, the further you get out here, the further you are away from the source of the neutrino flux, and there's a negative entropy gradient that can also drive convection and increase the efficiency of the heating here in this region. So an important point about the neutrinos here is that inside the protoneutron star, where they're essentially trapped, it's a diffusive regime where their angular distribution is essentially isotropic. And outside, as they transition to free streaming, they become more and more strongly forward peaked. So modeling the heating process here accurately requires that this angular distribution be tracked, because the energy transfer from the neutrinos to the matter depends upon that angular distribution. Okay, so there are many interesting observables that one would like to understand in connection with core collapse supernovae. Chief among them, of course, is the explosion itself, which we think of as our first observable. So 99% of the gravitational energy is released as neutrinos. Only 1% is actually in the kinetic energy in the explosion, and only another 10% or so of that, so maybe a thousandth of the initially released gravitational energy, is actually in the optical display. That optical display is brighter than the rest of the optical output of the rest of the galaxy that the supernova is in for the short time, but still energetically it's only a small detail. Nevertheless, the optical display is what we can detect with our inborn unaided detectors, our eyes. So in our sort of anthropic chauvinism, that's what seems like the most interesting observable to try and explain. But the neutrinos, from nature's point of view, are really what this this phenomenon is all about. And the detection of neutrinos on a time scale of seconds from supernova 1987A provided a good confirmation of the prediction of trapped neutrinos that diffuse on a time scale of seconds. So that was a nice bit of confirmation of theory. Of course, pulsar spins and the kick velocities generated, and magnetic fields, which I didn't say anything about in that narrative I gave you previously, the standard story of what goes on, but may also play an important role. And of course, the topic of interest here are gravitational waves that could be generated during collapse and afterwards. And there are others, element abundances that are formed, and of course the measurements across the electromagnetic spectrum of various kinds. So the simulations I'm talking about today are typically involved in, relate to these first few observables here, simulations of the guts of the collapse and bounce and trying to get at the explosion mechanism. There's a separate kind of simulation that's often done, where it's done kind of on a larger scale, where an explosion is sort of put in by hand or assumed, and the interaction of that with the outer layers of the progenitor star is studied to look at things more like the element abundances and make connections with the electromagnetic spectrum. But the kinds of simulations so far that the core collapse supernova simulations don't go out that far in radius and are focused more on these other things. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit about what's been done over the last few years in terms of supernova simulations. In a simulation, there's many pieces of physics that have to go in, of course. So, because neutrinos dominate the energetics, their treatment is very important. Are you treating them in multiple spatial dimensions? Again, I mentioned the dependence on both energy and angles that is important to track in order to calculate the radiative transfer accurately. This is, of course, extremely critical if, in fact, the neutrino-driven mechanism is, in fact, the mechanism by which these supernovae explode. Even if it's something entirely different, like magnetic fields or something else that turn out to be crucial, still for an accurate simulation, doing this well will be important because it's the dominant energy component of the system. There are relativistic effects in the neutrino transport, redshifts and trajectory bending and so forth. And of course, you want a comprehensive set of interactions. So hydrodynamics, maybe magnetohydrodynamics, and gravitation, of course, are also important physics in the system. And we saw that effects, fluid flows in multiple spatial dimensions will be important. And of course, eventually, general relativity should be included as well. The equation of state and composition of the matter, the treatment of dense nuclear matter, as well as the number and evolution of nuclear species, and are all important in involve a lot of cutting-edge nuclear physics. And another important aspect in this problem is accounting for lepton number and total energy. So you have 10 to the 53 ergs, roughly, of gravitational energy that's converted into neutrinos and released, compared to about 10 to the 51 ergs, or about 1% of that, in the mechanical explosion. So if you lose 1% of your energy in this simulation, you've lost energy on a scale comparable to the phenomenon you're hoping to explain, and that's not an acceptable situation from the point of view of explaining the explosion. So this is something for which great care has to be taken. So in the during the 90s, a common kind of simulation that was done was to look at supernovae in multiple spatial dimensions. But the price that was paid for doing that was the use of simplified neutrino transport, where the transfer equation, say the Boltzmann equation or something equivalent, is integrated over angle and energy, and is thus very approximate. So one of the first groups to do these simulations in multiple dimensions, in two dimensions in particular, was at Los Alamos in the early 90s, and descended from that is recent work by Fryer and Warren in three dimensions. So here you see an isosurface of constant velocity, outward velocity of 1,000 kilometers per second. So these bulbs are sort of outgoing plumes, and the empty spaces here are downward flows. And they see explosions in these simulations. Explosions were also seen in work by a group at the University of Arizona, and a similarity between these kinds of simulations, again, was that they both used neutrino transport that was integrated over both angle and energy. In the inner part, they use diffusion, and to treat the transition to free streaming, they use what's called flux-limited diffusion, where some sort of prescription is made that connects the energy density to the flux. But because that's an externally imposed prescription, it's not really necessarily an accurate indication of how the neutrinos are being transported and how their energy transfer to the matter takes place. So also a group at Max Planck Institute in Garching did two-dimensional simulations, and they imposed neutrino fluxes externally and could vary them as a parameter, and if they cranked up the neutrino luminosity sufficiently, they saw explosions. But because these are parameterized models, it's not a serious self-consistent study. At Oak Ridge in the 90s, also two-dimensional simulations were done. They also had approximate neutrino transport like the others, but in a different way. Unlike the others, they kept energy dependence. They integrated over the angles of the neutrinos, but kept the energy dependence. But they had another restriction, which was that their neutrino distributions were taken from a spherically symmetric simulation and then imposed on two-dimensional hydrodynamics. And in their simulations, no explosions were seen, as you can see from the receding shock radius here. So at the end of the 90s, there is this nagging qualitative difference between these different kinds of multidimensional simulations. On the one hand, you had ones that averaged their neutrino transport over energy and angle, and those saw explosions. And in this case, you have one which was averaged in space, but energy dependence retained, and those did not see explosions. So the focus in the last few years has been on improving the situation with regard to the neutrino transport. So here's a simulation in spherical symmetry from the Max Planck group, and so they have energy and angle dependent neutrino transport, but they make some approximations to the collision integral. Nevertheless, they retain some energy in the energy and angle dependence. So this plot shows the trajectories of various mass shells as a function of time. And this dark curve, this heavy curve here, shows the radius of the shock, and its stagnation here indicates that no explosion is forthcoming. The Oak Ridge group also did simulations which involved energy and angle neutrino transport and spherical symmetry. And they didn't use the approximations to the collision integral that the previous group did. In addition, they're the only group to have done completely relativistic simulations, even though it's in spherical symmetry. And you can see the difference here between the Newtonian case and the relativistic case. There's a quantitative difference here, but no qualitative difference in the sense that there's explosions or not one way or the other when relativity is included. So another important aspect of these simulations is the great care they took in conserving lepton number and total energy in the problem. And because of the care they've taken to show that they've not lost more than 10 to the 51 ergs anywhere during their simulation, then this says that in spherical symmetry, things just don't seem to be exploding, and that makes a convincing case. The University of Arizona group has also come to the same conclusion in recent simulations with this more sophisticated neutrino transport. So, kind of the most recent thing that's come down is some simulations from the Max Planck group where they take their sophisticated neutrino transport and make a quasi two-dimensional version of it. What they exactly do is a little bit complicated, and I won't take the time to explain, but just say that what they've done is better than what's been done before. And so these curves here show the shock trajectories as a radius as a function of time for various models. And they're labeled by various letters here, for example, G1, G2, N1, N2, and so forth. The 1 and 2 denote pairs of simulations that had everything the same, except they were in one or two spatial dimensions. The sets, like G1 and G2 versus N1 and N2, denote different pieces of the physics that were included, whether they be various neutrino interactions left out or various terms in the neutrino transport that were left out. The only exploding model they saw was this one here, a two-dimensional model, but this model left out terms in the radiation transport, the neutrino transport equations that correspond to Doppler shifts and trajectory bending and angular aberration. So when those are included, even in two-dimensional versions, then the explosion is no longer happening. So it was claimed in the early 90s that convection provided sort of this robust mechanism that would always give explosions. But from these, you can see that that's not really the case, that you can get an explosion or not depending on how well you're treating the neutrino transport, and that shows that the details there really matter for the physical outcome. Okay, let me talk now about the TerraScale Supernova Initiative. Something that's happening here for the future, now and in the future. So this is a relatively large collaboration on the order of 20 PIs from several institutions, led by Tony Metzakappa at Oak Ridge, and of course with lots of postdocs and students and connections to many other people in the astrophysical community. And these various investigators have expertise in all the necessary areas that go into a supernova: the radiation transport, hydrodynamics, nuclear and weak interaction physics, as well as specialists in computer science. This initiative is funded by the Department of Energy through the SCIDAC program. SCIDAC stands for Scientific Discovery Through Advanced Computing. And involved in that is access to the DOE's TerraScale machines. So TerraScale, what does that mean? It means several times 10 to the 12 bytes of memory in these machines and floating point operations per second. And they're also, we have access to the expertise of teams specializing in various things that come up, like advanced solvers, advanced computational meshes, performance data management, et cetera, et cetera. So the mission of this initiative is to explain the supernova phenomena most closely associated with the explosion, so kind of the first several elements on that list, phenomena I put up before. And so let me tell you about some things that have been done in the collaboration so far. So one thing that's been done has been the inclusion of improved electron capture rates. So these rates were computed from hybrid shell model and random phase approximation models of the nucleus. And also, these rates were used on a nuclear statistical equilibrium distribution of various heavy nuclei, as opposed to just considering only an average mean heavy nucleus, as has been done in the past. So what difference did this make? It didn't make a qualitative difference, but there's a small quantitative difference in that the maximum excursion of the shock, here you can see in the red versus black curves, this is entropy per baryon as a function of radius and density and velocity. So this is, these traces are shown at the maximum excursion of the shock before it starts to fall back in the spherically symmetric case. And this maximum excursion gets about 10 kilometers further out and happens also about 30 milliseconds earlier. And both of those trends, even though they're only quantitative changes, are in the right direction to be helpful for an explosion. Another interesting thing has to do with what happens to stability or instability towards convection. So the instability towards convection is measured by something called the Ledoux criterion, which takes into account gradients in both composition, electron fraction in this case, and entropy per baryon. And so this is a plot of the Ledoux criterion here. Negative values indicate instability to convection. So the green and the red curves are what resulted from this simulation done with the new neutrino nuclear interaction rates. And so the Ledoux criterion is a bit more negative, which means it's more unstable to convection and may drive stronger convection, which could also be helpful when this is included in multidimensional simulations. So another interesting piece of work that's been done has involved pure hydrodynamic simulations. And this doesn't involve neutrinos or realistic matter composition or anything like that. This is just to try and understand some basic features of the hydrodynamics that go on post-core bounce. So it turns out that a standing accretion shock is a analytic solution in spherical symmetry. So this solid line shows the density of the density track of that in the analytic solution. And this was matched, its parameters were adjusted to match the supernova shock at the time of stall in a realistic simulation, but spherically symmetric simulation. And that was used as an initial condition for just a pure hydrodynamic simulation. And it turns out that in multiple dimensions, 2 and 3D, the standing accretion shock is unstable to the point of explosion even. So what happens is if there's a small deformation in the spherical shock, matter falling through it gets a lateral kick, and that generates vorticity that goes down to the neutron star surface and rebounds as an aspherical pressure wave. And as that goes out, it further distorts the shock and forms a kind of feedback. And the result of this feedback at the end of the day is that turbulent energy is increased, where turbulent energy is the kinetic energy of lateral motion, and the average shock radius increases, and all of this happens at the expense of internal energy in the gas in these simulations. So I have they've produced some movies of this. So here's a two-dimensional version. This red part is the neutron star, and the surface there is the shock, and it was perturbed and allowed to evolve. And so you can see the distortions growing, and low order, L equals 1, L equals 2 sort of modes being developed, and you see the average shock radius increased. And this is happening again with pure hydrodynamics and has nothing to do with neutrino heating or anything like that, but is a instability that could be working that may help in the explosion process. So that was in 2D, and you may wonder how much effect the axis is having there, the axis of symmetry. So they've done these also in three dimensions. And in this case as well, they see the low order modes, L equals 1, L equals 2 sorts of modes being excited there. So that was a surface rendering. And for what it's worth, they did a volume rendering as well, which you can kind of see in a different kind of perspective that tries to let you see through to the interior. It's the same data. Okay, so these interesting fluid motions can generate some, have a time-varying quadrupole moment, and so can generate gravitational waves. Now, these simulations, I should emphasize, were Newtonian, and so these waveforms were just computed just by looking at the time-varying quadrupole moment. So the sorts of amplitudes for H that you're seeing are of order 10 to the minus 23, and the frequencies generated by this turbulent flow after the core bounce are in the tens of hertz or so. So this is a LIGO 2 sensitivity plot, and this is sort of the amplitude that was shown on those figures and the range in frequency, and looks to be somewhat outside the detectability range. Those were computed at 10 or 20 kiloparsecs, I think, so roughly the size of the galaxy. Okay, so this work with good neutrino transport that has been done in spherical symmetry has to be extended to multiple spatial dimensions. So that's another aspect of what's going on in the TerraScale Supernova Initiative. So one thing we've looked at is conservative formulations of general relativistic kinetic theory. Again, we don't want to be losing 1% of our neutrino energy that's sloshing around here in the problem. So here's the relativistic Boltzmann equation, and the left-hand side here describes the advection of the neutrino distribution function f in phase space. And so this operator is just closely related to the geodesic equations describing classical particle trajectories. And so the first term involves space-time derivatives, and the second term involves momentum derivatives. And so it's here that all the relativistic effects come in, like redshifts and aberration due to trajectory bending. as well as Doppler shifts involved between a transformation between the co-moving frame and the static lab frame. The collisions are described in the co-moving frame. So there's Lorentz boosts also that enter into this, as well as if you use curvilinear coordinates, of course, that makes a contribution here as well. And then you have the collision integral on the right-hand side that describes particles entering or leaving various classical trajectories. So just to take number conservation as an example, a number flux vector is the first momentum moment of the neutrino distribution function. And again, because we are describing the collisions in the fluid frame, the co-moving frame, that involves a transformation here between the number vector measured in the lab frame and the momentum components in the co-moving frame. So this number flux vector obeys a conservation law, its divergence, or a balance equation, really. And if you compare it with the Boltzmann equation, you see that it should just be an integral, a momentum integral, of the Boltzmann equation. But it's not entirely obvious how that works out, because here in the number flux vector, you have this spatially dependent transformation between frames inside the space-time derivative, whereas in the pure Boltzmann equation, it was outside the space-time derivative. Similarly, when you integrate over momentum here, you see that you've got this momentum-dependent stuff outside the momentum derivatives, and it's not readily apparent from this formulation what happens to those. So the point is that because of these differences of stuff being inside or outside the derivatives, it's not clear that a numerical implementation of this bare Boltzmann equation numerically will be consistent with this number conservation equation. And there's a similar issue, of course, in energy. The stress energy tensor of the neutrinos is the second momentum moment there, and the similar issues arise. So one of the things we've done is to formulate conservative formulations of this. By that we mean that these derivatives, the space-time and momentum derivatives, are instead expressed as divergences in space-time and momentum space. And numerically implementing those, then you have a better chance of having that match up with the conservation laws. So that's one detail about the radiation transport we worry about, since these conservation issues are such an important part of being able to say anything about the explosion or not. So we also have to develop a spatially multidimensional energy and angle-dependent neutrino transport solver for massively parallel machines. Just to get a sense of the magnitude of the challenge of this, in two spatial dimensions, for resolution you would like to see in momentum space as well, your solution vector alone involves 10 to the 9 elements, 10 to the 9 variables you're trying to solve for. In three spatial dimensions, it would be, your solution vector would be of order 10 to the 12 elements. This is for a uniform grid. And this alone would use up all the memory on DOE's terascale machines. So in addition, because of the rapid timescales involved in neutrino transport, the solution cannot be done explicitly, but has to be done implicitly, which means at the core of your algorithm, you've got a large, very large linear system to solve. And 10 to the 9 squared, needless to say, would not fit in a linear solve. So we have to take advantage of the particular structure of the transport equation and use various pieces of these operators at a time where we don't have everything in memory at once. So we've seen some good results with this in simple, smaller toy problems, and hope to use this in larger scale simulations in the next year or so. Towards three dimensions, then, looking at this challenge, an adaptive mesh will probably be required. So this new multidimensional radiation transport code is being developed in the context of what we hope to call Genesis, a name we've given with all the hubris we can muster, totally unjustified at the present time, of course, which stands for General Astrophysical Simulation System. So here's just a toy two-dimensional shock problem. Here's high density in red and low density in blue, and shows how the mesh adapts to it. We're doing this a little bit differently than how the adaptive mesh has been done with pure hydrodynamics. The thing that's been done most often in pure hydrodynamics is to use what's called a block structured approach to the AMR. And here the idea is you have separate blocks that can be placed in various places, and they can be overlapping or whatever. And an explicit time evolution is used to individually evolve these blocks. And the point is to take a simple serial solver and apply it independently on each of the blocks you have. But because in the radiation hydrodynamics case, we need an implicit solution, this implicit time evolution requires that you address the entire mesh structure at once. So you need an integrated solver for this whole mesh structure that doesn't simply treat each block separately. And so we're doing this instead of the block structured approach. We're using a zone by zone refinement method, which we think will prove more natural to the needs of radiation hydrodynamics. So here's a time scale of what TSI hopes to accomplish. Started in fiscal year 2002, looking first, continuing some aspects of spherically symmetric models, then moving into two spatial dimensions, and hopefully in the outward years get to three spatial dimensions, which again is really a 60 problem when you take the momentum variables into account. Okay, so the summary for gravity aspects, which are of most interest here today. So we have, of course, a solution to all the numerical problems associated with numerical relativity, and that is to simply pretend that Riemann and Einstein and everybody were never born and just use Newtonian gravity. So that's our solution that we offer in our simulations, at least for the next few years. The collapse has been done in spherical symmetry, so we're not seeing right now, and most of the community, most all that's been done has been done this way. So we're not seeing, can't say much about signatures that might happen during non-spherically symmetric collapse. The reason for that is there's very few progenitors that are not spherically symmetric. And also, modeling collapse in multiple dimensions requires an Eulerian evolution from very large radius to very small radius, and that's extremely challenging computationally. So the thing that's typically done is to evolve a spherically symmetric progenitor in Lagrangian way, which is more tractable, and then shortly after bounce, add seed perturbations that develop into the convection and things that you see. So I showed some post-bounce evolution, an example of a hydrodynamic instability that can happen, and the sorts of signals, and the conclusion from the plot I put up there that it looked like they were too weak to be seen with LIGO, at least. So even though we're doing basically Newtonian simulations, we are still thinking relativistically and expect to use relativity down the road, and I showed the radiative transfer that we're using a relativistic formalism to include everything with. So we're developing this Genesis and AMR code with radiation transport, and so this will be necessary in the supernova case, but we also hope to make some progress on the sort of dirty astrophysics side of neutron star mergers in terms of having realistic nuclear matter that when it's heated up always emits neutrinos and things. So we hope we can begin to make a contribution on that side of that problem. And of course, eventually we want to include full relativity in this code we're developing, and look forward to interacting with this community more, and many of you perhaps as individuals in that effort as well in the future. Thank you.
Questions? I don't think I understood the collapse in being done in spherical symmetry part, because if the collapse were really spherically symmetric, you would get dead zero for the gravitational waves, right?
Right.
So where are they coming from in the code? If it's, or am I misunderstanding what spherical symmetry means in this context?
So right after bounce, seed perturbations are artificially added that then grow into the sorts
and
of structure that's displayed.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's artificial. And, you know, you always, of course, I always, well, once in a while, lay awake at night wondering if it's garbage in, garbage out, since we don't have realistic progenitors. And, yeah, that's a concern.
The amplitude of the seed perturbation that determines the
I don't, yeah. So I don't know. I haven't been involved in those aspects myself personally, and I haven't taken the pain to know to what extent people have looked at different amplitudes of seed perturbations to answer that question myself. So I'm not sure whether it's sort of generic with amplitude of the seeds or not. Presumably people have checked various amplitudes, but I don't know myself to say for sure. There will be time scales for growth, I guess, that may depend on the amplitude.
For example, in the Bombo facility, that all the groups can go up under your amplitude.
If you wait long enough, I guess.
Well, if you put in a very, very small amplitude, it would have a very long time.
Right.
Other questions? I have one question. Are there any plans to eventually follow the collapse outside of spherical symmetry?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any plans to eventually work on following the collapse outside of spherical symmetry, or is that just something you're not interested in?
I think towards the end of this run of TSI, we would like to do that. There's a couple of non-spherically symmetric progenitors available, and we would like to do it. But because it involves going from such large radii to small radii, I think that process would probably benefit well from adaptive mesh refinement, and that's not quite ready yet. Yes. Yes.
Other questions? Okay, let's thank Christian again and Rick for